Time to take a look at the wonderful world of our Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here, Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. I was going to say emeritus professor, retired now, but he's still a wildlife ecologist as far as I'm concerned with UW. I doubt that he'll ever give up that education role that he's been done for all these years. Great to have him along. He comes by the first Wednesday of every month, and we talk about everything in the wildlife area. You may have some questions or comments for him as we move along today. What's the activity you've been noticing? Do you have a favorite place to watch wildlife? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And post on my Facebook page, too. We'd love to have, if you've got some great wildlife photos, always love those, and you want to accompany them with a question or comment, that's great as well. Scott, wonderful to have you back.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm trying to figure out where I was last month, but now I remember I was in Georgia having a very good time doing a conservation leaders program, and the weather was great. But it's nice to see that spring has finally gotten here, or at least it's a more normal spring than the bizarre weather we had last year.
I've actually seen a robin.
Yeah, everything just
cardinals
about
galore.
Last Friday or so, all of a sudden, red-winged blackbirds, robins, there have been lots of cranes around for quite some time. The cowbirds got back to my feeders yesterday, and everything's happening very quickly now. The birds seem to know. When they first showed up, I said, wow, guys have made a mistake, but it's finally coming along.
Yeah, those first cardinals, I thought, man, we got a foot, 2 feet of snow on the ground. What are you doing? But they must have survived, and birds, birdathon. We got a birdathon to talk about, I know.
Yes, the Great Wisconsin Birdathon is coming up in May, and it's a chance for everybody. I know there are lots of listeners to the program and always have been who are concerned about bird conservation and support things like Bird City USA and all the other initiatives in the state on bird conservation. Well, here's a really good one, and you can find out all sorts of things about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon at wibirdathon.org. And there was a really nice summary article about the birdathon in the current issue of Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine.
Just got my copy in the mail.
Yeah. I just got mine yesterday. Basically, it's...
You're in that, aren't you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there are a number of ways people can participate. And one of them is, this is all about raising money, having people have fun with birds, but also raising money that will go toward all the bird conservation initiatives in Wisconsin. And one of those ways is through Birdathon celebrity teams. And in the magazine, there are seven of them listed, including one called the Northern Highlands Team. And I know we've got lots of listeners up in the Lakeland area, Minocqua, Woodruff, Eagle River area. They call in all the time. And it happens that the Birdathon overlaps with our summer field course up at Kemp Station that we've been doing for years. So myself, David and Jamie, the three of us from the wildlife program, have set up a celebrity team. We're called the Northern Highlands Team, Scott Craven, Jamie Knack, and David Drake. And our goal is to organize our students, our other colleagues there with us at camp, and the three of us to go out and bird intensively over a 24-hour period of the third week in May, and try and get as many birds as we can. And this works like walkathons and other things where people pledge based on the number of species that a group turns up. So that's one thing people who are interested can do. They can get onto the Birdathon website and pledge to the celebrity teams like ours. They can go out and do a Birdathon on their own with an experienced guide. There are a number of field trips coming up with the Natural Resources Foundation that are involved with that. You can actually go out and bird as an individual and get involved in collecting pledges. And then you don't need to go out and bird at all. You can pledge in a variety of ways. So there's all sorts of things you can do, but it's a really cool way to support bird conservation.
I'll have to put a couple of bucks toward your team.
I would appreciate that, and the goal is to raise $40,000 to help state birds, and I think that's well within reach. There's a lot of people involved with this, and it's gotten a lot of publicity. Should be fun.
So I have to go to online?
Wisconsin Birdathon, just wibirdathon.org, and that will guide you through to get to the various ways you can either participate or participate through pledging. And the celebrity team that I'm involved with Jamie and David, is the Northern Highlands team. So we'll be tearing around. In fact, for our listeners in the Minocqua area, where we'll be based out of Kemp, if you've got a real good birding hotspot around there, give me a call or drop me an email, and we'll dispatch a hit squad of three or four of our students to add birds to our list. So there you have it.
There we go. Wow. Well, that'll be a lot of fun. Louise in Dodgeville has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi, good morning. I have seen lots and lots of turkeys out and about recently, like it just seems within the last week. They're just everywhere, kind of in groups of six and seven. So just wondering if it's just the change of weather, more sunlight that they're out and about, or what's kind of going on with their, you know, seasonal cycle, if you will.
Well, good question. Turkeys tend to break up the large winter flocks when the snow starts to disappear. And unlike last year, I think they said on the news last night, this was the first March in a long, long time, or almost since they've been keeping weather records,
We had always had
constant snow.
Snow
cover every day in the month of March. Very unusual and certainly grossly different than last year. So the turkeys have been kind of constrained in their movement along with a lot of other wildlife while we've had this deep snow cover for such a long time. So now things are breaking up. Most of the south slopes are open. Everything should be open by the weekend. And like any other animal and people, everybody's chomping at the bit to get out and move around, and the turkeys are no different. Plus, the breeding season is literally upon us as far as turkeys are concerned. So the flocks are breaking up. The hens are starting to split up. The gobblers are moving off to do their thing. And that's an interesting segue into the fact that the Wisconsin Youth Turkey Hunt is this weekend.
Yep.
To take advantage of that seasonal breeding activity when the gobblers are vulnerable, the male turkeys are vulnerable. And then the first regular turkey season period opens next Wednesday, I think, on the 10th. And runs for six consecutive weeks. So it's turkey season in every sense of the word, in hunting and in terms of turkey activity. So you don't have to be a hunter. I mean, turkey's a big, spectacular bird.
Fun to watch.
The gobblers are just beautiful, and you can get out there on the edge of a field somewhere where they're active and hide a little bit, and you could even get a turkey call and call one in to get a good look at it just to take a picture or just to see the bird. You don't need to be a turkey hunter to be out there doing that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for calling. And Cass in Appleton, hello to you.
Good morning. Last night I saw, it was like about 9:15 last night, about a dozen snow geese flying by. Is that unusual for them to be in this area?
In the Appleton area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were dozen snow geese.
Well, I guess, no, it's not that unusual, although we're kind of on the eastern edge of snow goose range in terms of the flyways and movements. But, I mean, there are other big white birds that are around. You're pretty sure they were geese?
Yes. A couple of weeks back, I was hunting them actually in Missouri.
Okay, so then. All right, then. Okay. You know what you're looking at. But it's a little unusual. But we see snows and blues occasionally, and we see white fronts occasionally. They're just birds that we associate a little more with further west.
Yeah. All right. Good luck. Thanks. Thanks a bunch for calling in. And you can call in, too, by the way. Maybe you have a wildlife question for our guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Or go to my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show. Post a photo there or a question. We'd love to hear from you. We, in fact, I believe, had a Facebook question from Kathy. There are more than the usual number of crows in Superior. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen them attacking ravens and eagles and squirrels. Anything?
Well, I don't know that there's anything particularly strange going on up there.
Okay.
If anything, I would speculate that the Northwoods still has snow.
Yeah.
It's thigh deep in the woods, and it's going very slowly. So I think a lot of a lot of wildlife activity may have been moved or shifted into areas where they've found open territory, like communities, for example.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Crows that might otherwise have been out along the lakeshore there or in more rural settings may just have congregated in town to find some open space and some food resources. So I've not heard of any particular influx, and I'm guessing when things open up there, crows will disperse, and that'll be the end of that.
David in Madison wonders how many are four-legged badgers common in Wisconsin. Lots of two-legged ones.
Well, badgers are widely distributed in the state, and they're not rare, but they're not common, and they're pretty. I'm not trying to be elusive. It's just one of those animals that occurs throughout the whole state at fairly low densities. They attract a lot of attention, of course, because it's an animal that people can readily identify, and it's kind of cool to see one, although I've, over all the years I've been in Wisconsin, seen a few that have been hit and killed along the highway. I'm trying to think back. I've yet to see a live one in the field, I guess.
I haven't.
And
dead ones,
you know, I spend a lot of time in the field, but have not seen a live badger yet. I know they're out there, and over the years on the program, we've had people send in fantastic pictures where they know there's a den, and the badgers get a little acclimated to activity of a farmer going by on machinery or whatever. You get some fantastic pictures, and they're neat to watch and so forth, but I'd say not rare to the point of we're worried about their populations, but not common so that it's an everyday occurrence to see one.
An email from Lori in Milwaukee wondering, when do bats come out of hibernation? It's kind of an interesting side story for this, Scott, that in our building on campus, we had a bat, this is about 2 weeks ago, flying around and sort of safely trapped it. And someone from the DNR actually came and picked it up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember when I was on campus more regularly before retirement and did a lot of work with the campus pest control person, you remember, Doug. It was pretty common for him to be removing active bats from campus buildings throughout the winter. And when I needed a live bat for the vertebrate ecology class, I knew I could always call Doug and say, hey, Doug, if you get a bat in the next week, and he almost always had one for me.
Yeah.
So warm spells or a roof heats up, and they become active and find their way into a building. But as far as their activity patterns outside, they're, of course, cued they need flying insects.
Yeah.
And it's just been the last few days that I've noticed the cluster flies and a few things like that starting to get active and move around. So about half our bats will be coming back from migratory ventures. I'm pretty sure red bats have already been back for a while and are active. The bats that would be emerging from people's homes and roosts and so forth, we should be right on the cusp of that if it hasn't happened already.
Actually, Alex in East Fifield Heights wondered about getting, he had bats entering his cabin via ridge roof vents. How do you fix that problem?
Well, he should move fairly quickly to seal that ridge vent. And I had to do the same thing on our cabin 2 years ago, and it was just a matter of getting up there, affixing the vent, and then sealing it up with roofing compound and whatnot to get a nice tight seal and make sure the screen was intact. And we haven't seen a bat in the cabin since, so it worked. But you need to do that pretty quickly, and he needs to be relatively sure that bats
There's
don't overwinter in,
there. In
the cabin, because the last thing you want to do is trap them inside. So he's got a little window of opportunity here with the snow and ice off the roof and the bats not particularly active to get that repair done, and then that should be the end of it. But any type of bat proofing now, as far as the state's concerned, with the new regulations packet dealing with bat management and white nose syndrome and so forth, I think it's June 1st to August 15th, that's a no-no. So
gotta do it.
Got a window. Got a window to do it. Get out and do it.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Gabby Pedriani, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on this edition of the Larry Mueller Show. We're talking Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension. Great to have you listening in. Always a pleasure to have Scott drop by. And our lines are filled, and we've had some emails and some Facebook questions, too. One question that's come up has to do with woodchuck hunts.
Oh, geez.
My goodness, what a bunch of publicity about that.
Well, there's, yeah, been a lot of smoke, but not much fire. But is this when you want to talk about this, Larry?
Well, let's just talk about it for a minute and get this out.
Yeah,
of
the bottom line is that woodchucks, or groundhogs as they're also known, have been protected in Wisconsin for a long time. I think the protection was instituted back in the 40s, and it was initially because these animals did a lot of digging and excavating, and those burrows were useful to other types of wildlife. Since that time, they've become considerably more abundant. And there have been rumblings I've heard them for 20 years, that, oh, woodchucks could easily be removed from the protected species list. And in reality, there's a landowner exclusion clause. So, you know, I know you for years removed them from under your deck along the lakeshore. Yeah. I've removed them from my garden. Anyone on a piece of land who's having trouble with woodchucks in a garden or a rock wall or whatever could deal with them. So now, all of a sudden, there was a proposal in the legislature to open a woodchuck hunting season. Well, first of all, this isn't a quantum change from the status quo, since people were unable to deal with them on their own land anyway.
Yeah.
But all that really needed to be done here was to remove woodchucks from the protected species list, put them along in the category with possums, ground squirrels, most small rodents, and so forth. End of story.
Yeah.
No big deal, and probably no big impact on woodchucks one way or the other. But somehow it got pitched as a hunting issue, like the feral cat fracas a couple years ago, or the dove season before that, which did in fact go into effect. And in reality, I just don't hear huge demand or interest for hunting woodchucks. They're not that conspicuous or abundant. I just don't see it as being a huge interest. So all we really needed to do was lift the protection and let people go about their business to decide how they and woodchucks were going to interact, period. But once it got spun as a hunting issue, of course, then it's, oh, my gosh, it's just one more thing that hunters want to shoot. And, you know, I got quoted as making a comment that, well, a hunting season wouldn't really change animal population in a general sense. And in reality, many of our most common game species, think about Canada geese, snow geese, white-tailed deer, incredibly abundant, to the point of being pest species in some people's minds. And hunting, although certainly many of them are taken, has not proven to be particularly successful at reducing the population where management agencies want it. And all species that are hunted are regulated so tightly that if there's a detected population effect, then the hunting pressure is constricted. So not a big issue there, but this notion bothers me a lot that there's a push out there to hunt everything. There are about 1,150-some species in North America. Only about 145 are on the game species list, about 12%. And the candidate species amongst those other 900 are few and far between.
Yeah.
Because a game species has to have some attributes. They have to be abundant. They have to be widespread. They have to be sporting in some way, palatable, all sorts of characteristics that go in. So the idea that woodchucks are just another notch and pretty soon it'll be bluebirds and robins and who knows what is just a lot of nonsense. But in the case of the woodchucks or groundhogs, all we really had to do was alleviate this protected status and go about our business, and no one would have lifted an eyebrow. But once it's pitched as hunting, it just stirs up a firestorm, and it's a tempest in a teapot, really.
You know, I bet most people listening have probably seen a woodchuck or even seen them out in the field and certainly have seen pictures otherwise. I have a little audio of a woodchuck whistle.
Well, let's hear it.
Yeah. Sounds almost like a bird, doesn't it?
Yeah. They're an interesting animal. If they're not causing any particular problem, no need to be too worried about them. But they're basically a rodent. They're a big, fat ground squirrel for the most, realistically. And they climb. For a short-legged, rotund animal, they actually climb very well, like the squirrel that they are, so to speak. So You know, this is just one of those things that it's unfortunate it created. Part of it maybe because they, hey, Groundhog Day and Sun Prairie, Jimmy the Groundhog and so forth. But this whole proposal is not a big threat to the woodchuck population. And it was really only a matter, I think, or could have been a matter of making things easier for people and woodchucks to coexist. But so it goes.
Travis and Neverino, thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hey, I was wondering if your guest knew anything about egrets, the white egrets. And the Navarino Nature Center, I've been seeing so many of them every year, and when I was a kid, I never remember ever seeing any of them, and no one ever says anything about them.
Well, there's a couple of different species, and in some of the big marshes in Horicon and some of the other big wetland marshes, they've become fairly commonplace. I'm not that familiar personally with current population trends, but this is one of those cases where we've got, as we mentioned discussing the birdathon, lots of really good birders out there listening. And if someone wants to come in and give us their take on egret populations and which way they're going and which species you might be seeing, we would appreciate that assistance. So let's see what we get.
Okay, I was just, because they always seem to be in a flock, and that seems so different from like blue herons, and that you only see five or six of them at a time. So I was just wondering.
Yeah, and I think in part that's a matter of, for one thing, they're white, so they're very conspicuous. You know, you might see a green heron, for example, or some of the other species sitting on a log protruding from the water. So, oh, there's a green heron or blue heron or whatever, and there could be three or four more in the area, and you just don't notice them because they're a lot more cryptic. Whereas the egrets stand out like a sore thumb, and I think part of that is their flocking behavior, but part of it also is they tend to be concentrated in marshy areas and wet and flooded areas where you'd expect birds of a feather to flock together, so to speak.
There you go. Okay. Thanks, Travis, for calling. And Julius in Waterford, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Got a question about blue herons. When you just mentioned it to the previous caller, I live on Lake Michigan, and in the last week we had a big heave in the ice, and a place probably 100 feet by 100 feet opened up out in the middle over 60 feet of water.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 3 days, well, there's always seagulls, an occasional eagle, birds like that circle these open holes, but the last 3 days there's been four blue herons come. And they stand around this hole with the rest of the birds. The shorelines are open in part. What are they doing out in the middle of the lake? I'm sure fish don't come up in that hole for them. And I watched them with binoculars, and they don't appear to be attempting to catch a fish. Like along your shore, every once in a while, you see them come up with a small bluegill or with nothing they missed and something like that. Why would they be out in the deep water like that? They're standing on the ice, on the edge of the ice, looking into the hole.
And you're sure they're blue herons as opposed to, I mean, in the last week or so, there have been lots of herons coming back, but also lots of cranes. And I've seen both species just kind of standing around on the ice as if they're thinking, wow, you know, we could have stayed in Illinois an extra couple of days before we got back to stand around on the ice here until things open up.
Yeah,
but
matter of fact, there's two sandhills flying over right now.
Okay.
They are not a sandhill.
Okay.
They are definite blue heron. And I lived out here 24 years and have never seen this before. I've seen the water open up and the seagulls flock and a few eagles and stuff like that, but never blue heron.
Well, I can't explain the behavior of those few individual birds unless there's something out there that, you know, if it's out there a ways, is Michigan fairly shallow?
No,
it's deep out there. They're
over.
All right. Well, you know, I just wondered if there was something going on with all the snow cover we had, if there was any kind of winter kill or other problem that was bringing something up there in the water that was attracting the birds, other than just the fact that there's some open water to be around. So I have no better explanation for you than that.
There you go, Julius. But thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Ralph in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Ralph. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share with you that I grew up on a farm here in rural Wisconsin Dells along the Wisconsin River. And I put together a list of the critters, various kinds of wildlife that I did not see growing up here in the 1940s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to share that with your guests.
Okay.
That I've seen.
So these are species that seem to have arrived on the scene fairly recently.
After 1950s, for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
You want to give us that quickly?
Okay. Wolves, coyotes, yeah. Eagle, osprey, turkeys, seagulls, sandhill cranes, black bear, turkey vultures, pelican.
Yeah.
New critters that I've seen here since I grew up.
And that's the Wisconsin Dells area.
Right.
Well, I mean, that list mirrors exactly the species that have, in fact, increased dramatically since those days. And if you, at the recent meeting, the DNR held their statewide wildlife management conference in the Dells three weeks ago, back-to-back with the Wildlife Society meeting, and the former director of the Bureau of Endangered Species, Chuck Pills, gave a very nice talk on success stories and changes over the last 30, 40, 50 years in terms of wildlife populations. And many of those were on that list. If you think back to Leopold's work in the 30s, he commented that there were but a handful of cranes in the state. And now, thousands of cranes. Eagles were on their way out for many years with pesticide problems and assorted other things. And now we've got eagles nesting all over southern Wisconsin, let alone the Dells area. And turkeys, of course, everybody's familiar with that success story. They were all but gone and then restored with the reintroductions that began in the mid-1970s. Bears have been moving south for the last few years and have become very abundant, and on down your list. Uh-huh. So, I mean, it's actually nice to see that what people are experiencing is reflective of what's actually been going on with wildlife population trends. So that's an interesting record. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Ralph. Appreciate the call. And we had, here's an interesting photo on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Ed took this picture last September. This was a bee nest in the ground, and it was dug up. And he wonders, what animal would do the digging of a bee nest like that? He lives in southern Wisconsin, Genoa City area, southern Wisconsin.
I'm trying to see there. It looks like it's pretty well excavated.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of things. I can't tell the scope there of size, but skunks will certainly raid bee colonies and are notorious for that. If it was a little further north, of course, bears are also notorious for causing that kind of a problem.
Raccoons,
I don't know if a
do
badger
it?
Would tackle that or a raccoon or not, but without the scale in that area,
yeah.
I think skunks are a good possibility, but I don't know whether he saw any tracks or any other sign of the animal around there.
Yeah, it doesn't look like
I can't see much
can't
from
see
my
anything, no.
From my vantage point here.
Sylvia in Appleton has a question. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I have a couple quick comments on the snowy egrets. Disappointed that they were taken off the endangered species list because I've been seeing them since the 1990s. On a regular basis, few and far between.
Okay.
And also the common egrets, they have, since I've been birding for 40 years, their numbers have gone down considerably, though there was a nice gathering at Horicon last year.
Okay. So in terms of the birds that we think our caller was seeing up at Navarino, are you thinking snowies or commons? Or
they're probably common egrets.
Okay.
But unfortunately, I think the cormorants have usurped them in a few places. But also, a couple of us were fortunate in seeing for the birders, a common golden-eye hooded merganser hybrid down by Riverside Park in Nina.
Wow. How did someone even make that call? What did it look like?
There's one picture on Facebook that we found that looked very similar to it. There's a number of them which didn't look anything like it, but there have been reports of similar birds being spotted in the United States. And it had the hood, the merganser bill, small white slash, but the head was dark, all dark except for a little slash by the eye.
Hmm.
The side was the grayish of the hoodie, but it had the white feathers on the back like a golden eye.
And they're both cavity nesters, aren't they?
Yes.
So you
which
could kind of see how that happened, I suppose.
Right.
somebody jumped in the wrong hole and all of a sudden in the tree, and there you were. What about back to the egrets for a second? What about the chances of cattle egrets or any of the other species?
There was a nice showing of common egrets down at Horicon last year, but as far as other places that we bird, we're just not seeing them like I used to.
Okay.
And the other, I do have one question. When I'm fishing, I often pick up a lot of the little lead sinkers.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something place that those can be taken so that they won't be made into sinkers again?
There are often, I think, depending on where you are, keep your eye open for tackle exchanges that some fishing groups and conservation groups and so forth offer, or local nature centers where you can actually bring in lead jigs, lead sinkers, other lead-based tackle, and exchange it for non-toxic tackle.
Or
at least turn it in so that, and I assume it's recycled in some way and gets out of the environment.
Okay.
So I see that occasionally up around the Minocqua area and other mm-hmm. places where there are lots of fisher persons concentrated. Otherwise, you know, check with a big tackle vendor like Gander Mountain or some outfit like that in the fishing department and see what they say about recycling those things.
Okay.
Otherwise, I think any recycling center that handles lead, which occurs in a lot of other things from batteries and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
would be able to handle it and dispose of it for you.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Gary in Kenosha recently saw 15 swans swimming in Lake Michigan near Kenosha. He's wondering if this is normal. No, 15 swans?
Well, not yet. I mean, they're coming back through, and the fields, as soon as things really open up and flooded fields, we should be seeing lots of swans going through, and it's a much more leisurely movement for them this time of year when they go over in the fall. We hear them go over, but they tend to not stop as much on their way to wintering areas. I guess the real question is what swans he's seeing, since lots of tundra swans move through, and there's thousands and thousands of those. But of course, the trumpeter restoration has led to those turning up now, although not usually in that number. And then, of course, there are still some problems in some communities and areas with mute swans. So I guess the real issue, not unusual to see groups of swans, but the question, of course, then is which swan was Gary actually seeing?
Oh, interesting. Melissa, feels like the Wisconsin Conservation Congress needs to hear from a more diverse section of the population. She's not opposed to hunting, but there are some kinds of things that she is opposed to, or at least like another voice to be heard, hunting wolves with dogs, for example. She wonders, and this is, I think, is just a good general question for anybody, how do we get people to get out and vote for delegates to represent, you know, what her view, or represent living wildlife, and can you leave some of these in her view, opinion confusing and no way to answer the question that reflects her views, such as question number 48 through 51, as she puts on the about using dogs to fight and hunt wolves?
Well, it's a very good question. In fact, we had it on the hit list today because the hearings are coming up. The Conservation Congress hearings are coming up this coming Monday, April 8th. I think they all start at 7 o'clock or thereabouts. There are 72 of them around the state. Every county will have one. And you can go to the DNR website and find out specifically where they're held in your county, usually a high school auditorium or something like that. And they are open to anyone. It is called the Conservation Congress, not the Hunters and Fishers and Trappers Congress, but I fully realize that over the years it evolved into a group that tended to focus on hunting and mm-hmm. basically consumptive use kind of issues. But it doesn't have to be that way. The reality is that it's sometimes not easy to get other people out to those meetings because they may feel somewhat intimidated or out of place. But it has happened in the past with particularly counties that are dominated by a large urban area where they have been able to get large groups out. For example, think back to the kinds of crowds that were attracted when the dove hunting issue was on the docket. There were many people who were not hunters who came to the hearings. And I think it's a matter of a grassroots effort for like-minded people to get together through other kinds of organizations and say, hey, let's get the group together and go to the Congress hearings this Monday night and either attempt in the future to get other kinds of issues on the docket or to have their voices heard on the issues that are on the docket, like the use of dogs. And there are other things dealing with tree stands and motor trolling, but most of those are quite specific to people who are involved in hunting and fishing. But there's no reason why people can't go out and be heard.
No.
And the hearings are well managed. The conservation officers there to maintain decorum, and generally people are pretty civil. And I think it would be a good thing to see a broader base for that organization. So get out there, and it's got to start somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael in Washburn, hi.
Good morning, Larry and Scott.
Mike, good morning.
I was going to be a passive listener this morning because I'm out tending a sap boil, but when Scott started talking about the palatability of game species and on the heels of discussing woodchuck, I couldn't resist. So I grew up in central Illinois, and my brother and I hunted together down there. And Scott, you've worked with Ben. He's a Michigan State Human Dimensions.
Yep.
Retired now.
Yep.
And so you can appreciate this. And anything we shot, we ate. Have you ever eaten woodchuck?
I have not.
I have.
I described it to Judy as a as sort of a really greasy pork with a really strong game taste.
Oh, that doesn't sound attractive.
No, that sounds about right.
That sounds about right. And I thought, well, people are probably not going to spend a lot of time pursuing these things if they have to deal with that. And it was just a sport shooting, which I don't do anymore, and neither do a lot of people up here in Bayfield County anyway.
Right.
You're more looking to eat whatever it is you're shooting.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that's really the case, which is why we agreed that there's not I don't see or hear a groundswell of interest or support in woodchuck hunting, and the palatability issue is one of the many characteristics that go into determining the potential for a game species, but it's not absolutely necessary. Plus, taste is kind of a personal thing. I think of coots, for example. I'm not a big fan of coot, but some people can turn anything into some type of meal, and with some strong Cajun spices or ground up into a bratwurst, I think you could probably cook just about anything. But I don't think that woodchucks as a centerpiece on the Thanksgiving table is going to be a big motivator for folks.
No.
If the season comes to pass.
You may have known Dale Birkenholz down in Illinois State, or heard of him, and he was my major professor down there, and he used to cook coot, and we'd have these big coot cooks out, and his credibility in my eyes fell.
So is the sap running pretty well up your way?
It is, Larry. I just collected 50 gallons this morning.
Excellent.
And this is my second boil.
Oh, good. That's wonderful. Thanks, Michael. Thanks a lot. And you know what? We've got a little feature about maple syrup. And we'll play that right after we remind you that you're listening to Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As I said, we're going to talk a little bit about maple syrup. It's time for Wisconsin Life. We're going to play a little feature from Wisconsin Life for you. Bear Paw Scout Camp lies in the middle of the Nicolet National Forest. The camp is alive with activity, not only in the summer, but during maple syrup season as well. And Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Connolly went to join in the fun.
As winter melts into spring in our state, many Wisconsinites begin their preparation for an annual harvest.
lighting the fire for the first time is always the best because you've been itching since last season to start making maple syrup again.
Derek Fournier started making maple syrup in 2005 at his home away from home in Mountain, Wisconsin.
Red Bear Pusco Camp. It's located in the Nicolet National Forest. I was lucky enough to be a member of the summer camp staff at this camp, and I noticed over the years that we had a number of sugar maple trees on the property, so I thought it'd be fun for just myself to just try making some maple syrup. It started with 15 taps, a pot, and a cooker underneath, burned a lot of propane, and just got interested in making more than that, doubled it the next year, tap more trees, and then you catch the maple bug, and you want to make more.
9 years later, with the help of Camp Ranger Andy Anderson and many volunteers, Bear Paw Scout Camp now taps over 800 trees, which boils down to roughly 200 gallons of syrup on a good year. A decent production for a small sugar bush. But selling their syrup and turning a profit isn't necessarily their goal.
It just seemed fitting to make a scouting program to teach other kids how to make maple syrup. Boy Scouts have merit badges, and we have a program we run. It's very similar to the requirements to earn a merit badge.
My name is Jason Brzezinski. I am the program director for Bear Paw Scout Camp's Maple Days. We run a program the last two weekends of March and the first weekend in April. The boys come up, they learn everything you need to know to make their own maple syrup from A to Z. We have eight stations throughout the day where they just have fun.
The scouts begin their day in the dining hall. After sampling some syrup on their pancake breakfast, they head off to their daily activities.
Well, there we got a section on history. Then we have a section where they actually see a sugar shack with an evaporator room and a bottling process.
As quick as we can. The front pan, the purpose is converting it to syrup.
We have a couple game stations, one where they're flipping the pancakes over their back and trying to catch them.
Keep your eye on the pancake at all times.
We have a cooking station where they learn how to use maple syrup in recipes.
Walgreens brown sugar plopping into that melted butter.
We have another one with Brace and Bit, which teaches them how to tap a tree. We show them how to collect it with buckets.
Connor Scott of Troop 741 came up from Hartford, Wisconsin to participate in Maple Days.
I like the fact that we all get to have our own bottle of maple syrup that we get to take home, and just being able to learn all about it and seeing that we can make it at home, too.
And on the back of every bottle is printed the program's true purpose.
Bear Paw Maple Syrup, making Boy Scouting sweeter, one bottle at a time.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. And that episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council with some support from Mead Winter Foundation of Wisconsin Rapids. And wisconsinlife.org. Go to wisconsinlife.org and you can find out more about that show, that feature, and the other features that Erica works on. And it, you know, it is. I've spent a little time around a sugar.
It's fun.
Bush, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Well, Bill in Oshkosh, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
I put in a good recipe for coot, which was gift you. I was noticing, as I was talking to her, the receptionist, that my phone cut out as I drove past the woodlot. Now, in the winter, it doesn't, because the reception gets through the trees. In summer, it blocks out my phone reception. So my question is, very silly question, is could you measure the amount, or do trees really swell in their branches and down to the twigs when the sap rises?
No.
No, because I was thinking they'd swell and that would have caused the interference, you know, just because they're, you know,
no, the bud,
200 yards of trees.
Yeah, the buds swell.
Well, the buds swell up, but I don't think there's a detectable change in the twigs. Not enough to bother phone reception.
Nope.
All right. Well, I just, you know.
Worth a question. Thanks,
interesting
Bill.
Question.
Thanks, Bill. We had a on Facebook, I believe, Kay at Beaver Dam is a devoted barn owl viewer on these cams on upstream. Wondering about the status of barn, now B-A-R-N we're talking about here, barn owls. She read that the last sighting of an active nest was 1985. Wondering if that was true.
Well, back if we're talking about Wisconsin, I mean, they're quite abundant in some parts of the country, but had always been rare. We were on the extreme fringe of their range in Wisconsin, and they were in the early years of the Endangered Resources Program. They got a lot of publicity and were kind of a poster child for a while, but I guess I don't know for sure about that 85 record, but I would say for the last at least decade or more, hardly hear any talk about barn owls as one of the species attracting attention in Wisconsin, as opposed to eagles and swans and a whole host of other species. So that may be one that's kind of fallen by the boards and fallen by the wayside in terms of much attention here.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that's a good segue into the Endangered Resources
Fund. Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Well, we wanted to be sure to bring up the fact that with tax time imminent here, I don't want to raise a black cloud over an otherwise nice spring day, but it is tax season and the deadlines are coming up for payment, and that always brings up at least some commentary urging people to, we used to talk about looking for the loon. Chances for people when filing their state taxes to make a donation to the Endangered Resources Conservation Program by making a donation at Look for the Loon. But the loon has vanished from the state forms, although you can still find an opportunity to donate to the Endangered Resources Fund. I believe it's line 37A under contributions.
Yeah.
So you can still make the donation, and it's especially important to do so because I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% to 30% or 40% of the endangered species work in the state is funded by the donation program. The donation program is also matched up to $500,000 by the state. But here's where the trouble comes in. Since 2002, for example, the donations from that checkoff, the Look for the Loon, have dropped from about $660,000 to a 12-year low of $285,000 and $212,000. That's a pretty significant drop. So that hurts when it comes to the conservation of these many, many species that are out there that are not attracting attention as game species or something else. Even the wolf plate and the revenue from that, which I think the numbers I have here, wolf plate has generated almost $9 million in sales since it was introduced in 1995. But sales of the wolf plate have dropped steadily in recent years, too, and there's some speculation that may be due to the changing status of wolves and so on. But nevertheless, that program relies heavily on public support in the form of donations, and here's a chance during the tax season to do that, and it's very much appreciated and needed by the state's wildlife.
And kind of the nice thing about it is, too, that every year, Renee and I do this every year, and it's also the time when I look back and find, okay, last year, how much did we donate? And I use that as a deduction on our taxes for this year.
Well, there you go.
That's the way to do it. Dan, Daniel sent us a Facebook picture. he stretched out his hunting license. He's got the patron license, which you and I get, too.
Mine looks like that as well.
And this banner does not include tags for fur-bearing animals, sturgeon, etc. With all the technology these days, barcodes, etc., do we really need all of this? I wish I had invested in the company making the green paper. And it is long. It's worth a look on the Facebook page, for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I looked at my own, and in reality, we still have a back tag regulation.
Yeah.
So a chunk of it is that back tag that goes on your back. And then there are, because of the ongoing effort to get the deer herd under control, there are a number of deer tags printed out there. And, of course, you need to use those as you tag the deer. So that's a chunk of it. And then when you add the receipt and maybe a goose permit and a couple turkey permits and so forth, it does get to be quite a long strip of paper.
That is an amazing strip of paper. Pam in Middleton, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if you had talked about the great gray owl that's been spotted here in Middleton over the past week or two. You have?
We plan to. So you're a perfect caller here, Pam.
We have it on the list here, and since you've brought it up, I just wanted to say that the appearance of that rather rare bird generated a whole lot of excitement. It's not often that wildlife makes the front page. Here's the State Journal of Friday, March 29th. And, you know, that's the most prominent thing on the front page of the paper. And it says Middleton is temporary home of a rarely seen but instantly popular visitor from Canada. And
Judith and her husband went over to see it. And Judith's husband took some great photos, and we put it up on my Facebook page. So it's at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page.
Well, I mean, a great gray is a big bird. It's very photogenic. They just look kind of thoughtful and pensive, and they're staring at you. And it attracted a lot of people from all over the upper Midwest to come and get a look at that bird, and it was very cooperative. I don't know if it's still around. I've known some people who tried to get out there in the last few days and couldn't find it. Where it is now, I don't know.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. He will be with us right up until 12:30. The news next coming up here, then we'll be back with Scott, so stay with us. The diversity and the riches of our Wisconsin wildlife, I guess it's one of the many things that make our state such a great place to live and brings people from all over. And you don't even need to head to the forests or the lakes of northern Wisconsin. You can sit in a local park in southern Wisconsin or central or anywhere, even in your backyard. You're going to see a lot more than you might think. Larry Mueller here, lucky to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven as our guide to the environment. He has some great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors and to be good stewards of nature. And maybe you have a question about our wildlife. You can join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. I hope you'll visit our Facebook page as well. We got some great photos there. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. See the photos. Post one of your own. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Back with Scott right after the news. Talking about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension. Great to have him along. He comes by the first Wednesday of every month. And, and next month, that's probably going to be May 1st. Yeah.
Yep. Mayday.
Mayday. He'll be with us, but he's here right now and ready to answer your questions when you call in at 800-642-1234. We've got lots of things to talk about. Braxton in Oakland, let's just go there. He's been waiting a long time. Braxton, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, long time listener. I have a cabin in New Auburn, and I like hiking the trails around there a lot.
Yeah.
And I was just concerned with the expanding wolf population. I'm not so worried about myself, but my dog and my daughter go hiking with me, too, and I was wondering if I have to be concerned about that at all.
Well, I'm not sure what to tell you, Raxon. We've had this question many times before, and these animals are becoming more abundant, and one of the incentives, whether it's working or not, of implementing a wolf season was to perhaps create a little more respect for people in these animals that previously were becoming rather bold. Only time will tell whether that helps or not. The reality of the situation is that, yes, they're a big, powerful animal, and their reputation precedes them and folklore and so forth, but the statistics suggest that few people get to see one alive, that there's virtually no precedent in North America for attacks on humans. Dogs are a different story. That should raise a little concern. You should keep the dog under control and either have an e-collar on it or have it on a lead or something so you have some control. But I think the risk is very low, but it's not zero. But the risk, there's risk inherent in driving to the trailhead from your cabin, which is low but not zero either. So we all take a variety of risks in our everyday life, although this is one that it's kind of easy to finger because it's on people's minds. It is a very low risk, but not zero, as I said. So keep control of the dog and be alert and maybe have a whistle or some way to make some noise or attention if you hear something. But I just don't think it's anything that someone should be anxious about when they're out in the woods in Wisconsin.
There we go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. And Maureen in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I have some questions and concerns about a gray fox resident that I have in my backyard. He kind of owns the neighborhood here. We have about acre plots. It's been about more than 5 years that he's a constant resident. One of my concerns is he, she and he, they've raised a couple litters of kits or pups and continues to dig under my little log cabin in the backyard. And I shore it up and I think I've done it. And they're so persistent, they keep digging under there. And right now they're under, and I'm pretty sure they're probably, if she's, do they have litters every year? I think they're
usually
about the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And one of the concerns I have is they're pretty, well, not aggressive, but they're
bold.
Bold.
Yeah.
And I do have cats, and he keeps coming onto our deck by the patio door, and he jumps at it so that he's kind of ripped the...
Oh, the fox green. Jumps at the cat?
Yes. And the cats jump at him, and then he jumps at them. And then, and it's usually about 3 in the morning. I'm not sure if he's worried that they're going to, you know, disturb his family, or I don't know quite what to do about it.
Hmm. Okay, well, interesting. You know, gray fox, they're beautiful animals.
Yes.
They're not that common. People don't often get a chance to see them, especially that close and personal. But this one seems to have become perhaps a little too bold. On the other hand, you describe living with it for 5 years now and
yes,
through several reproductive cycles, and they've successfully raised at least a couple of litters. So
yes,
from the fox's perspective, hey, this is a pretty good spot. You know, no one's bothering us. We're raising young and so on. So if you can continue that, if you can continue that peaceful coexistence, you know, after 5 years, that animal or that pair is not going to stay in, one of them is going to meet some problem here before too long, and that may be the end of it. On the other hand, some of the offspring may come back to take over the good spot. But if you're concerned about it, you could eliminate the den site. Probably not now. I wouldn't mess with it now. Let them go through another reproductive season. But then late in the summer when everybody's off on their own, I think it is quite possible to make that under part of your little cabin fox-proof by trenching around it and sinking, and have somebody do it with a trenching tool so you're not digging a huge trench, but run some galvanized wire down a foot to 18 inches, and bend it out. Make a trench wide enough so you flange it out on the bottom 5 or 6 inches. So even if they dig down along the wire, they're going to hit that sill and
not going to be able
to get around it. So
okay,
I think it's possible to make that fox-proof, and that may be enough come next fall or winter to cause them to move a little further away and give you some peace of mind. But in the meantime, I'd leave them alone, keep an eye on your cats, and enjoy watching them as you have for the past few years, and leave it at that.
Keep the cats inside.
Yeah, I suppose he could. Well, my cats are probably bigger than he is, but not taller. My cats are about 20 pounds, but yet, you know, my cats are kind of territorial, too. So
well, that's a fight you don't want to see, so
okay.
keep the cats in.
Yeah, you don't want... Because I'm going to tell you right now, the fox is going to win that fight. The fox will win. Thank you, Maureen, for calling. You know, we've got April 6th. There's a date that's stuck in my head, Scott. Something to talk about.
Yes, we wanted to mention
the deer czar.
Right. The DNR has been very active with messages from Secretary Stepp and other means of getting out to license holders and other interested stakeholders In that the action teams have been created to take a look at the report submitted by James Crowell, the so-called Dear Czar or Dear Trustee, with the 60-some recommendations that his committee of three made. And they're kind of in the implementation phase of all of this at this point, and fact-finding and preparation for implementation. Anyway, there are a series of meetings coming up, and the first big one here is this, let's see, 6th would be Saturday, I guess, coming up on April 6th at Stevens Point at the Dreyfus University Center on the Stevens Point campus. And there are meetings then scheduled throughout April, May, June, and July. All the meetings run from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in that same location. And the agenda for this first meeting on April 6th is the topic overview and brainstorming, and then moving through decision item development, wrap-up, and in the action team reports on implementing all of these proposals relative to deer hunting and deer management. So anybody who's got a stake in this, and nearly everybody does, here's another opportunity to have your voice heard, and that meeting's coming up on April 6th, this Saturday, in Stevens Point. So you can, and this is all laid out on the DNR website, and as I said, there have been email correspondence going out from Secretary Stepp and others. So that's a big issue. And, of course, one of the things on the docket will be what to do about chronic wasting disease. And that's...
What's the report on that, well, Scott? Anything updating?
It's kind of a sad situation. I mean, it hasn't gone anywhere, but it's fallen off the radar screen for a lot of folks. And the DNR literally has been struggling with what to do about it. Some of the extra seasons that were added have been, there's a retrenchment in that. But the fact of the matter is that it's been discovered in other locations around the country and a few other situations around Wisconsin. And the prevalence rate has continued a slow and steady increase. Yep. You know, when we first discovered it back in 2002, in that first testing, the prevalence rates were down around a percent or two at best, and especially in adult animals and especially in adult males in the core area in southwestern Wisconsin where it's discovered, those rates have slowly crept up to 15 to 20% or more,
man,
especially in adult bucks. So it's out there, yeah, but as far as human nature is concerned, there have been so many other things to think about, and there haven't been windrows of dead deer lying around. No one's gotten sick from eating one. So it's been hard to generate excitement and enthusiasm over continuing to stay the course. So I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I think it's quite clear that CWD is something we're going to be living with for a long time. But anyway, that's the current situation, and that deer incident. There is one other thing I wanted to mention, Larry, before we're going to run low on time here. As the snow has melted away in my yard, there's been lots and lots of mouse damage. And these little trails and tunnels in the lawn are the work of meadow voles or meadow mice, Microtus. And it's an overwinter problem. We had such long snow cover, they had a long time to be down there rooting around and chewing things up. And it looks awful, but it's generally a cosmetic problem, and when green up starts and the grass is growing vigorously, it'll be back. It may be a little worse than normal this year because there was lots of drought damage last year, so my lawn was in a lousy shape anyway.
Yep.
So I'm looking to do some overseeding here very shortly when the frost is all out of the ground and it's warmed up, and you may want to scrape away some of those mouse-damaged areas and throw a little extra seed down there, too. Generally, we don't have to do that. But that's the work of meadow mice, and they're long gone now back into cover, so there will be no further damage. But you just need to be aware that that was going on under the snow, and there's very little you can do about it. If they damaged woody plants, and I had a couple creeping and junipers, that there's not a stitch of bark on the whole plant. They ate everything under the snow, and some of those woody plants may have been girdled to the point that they'll die, but that's all the work of meadow mice.
And I wanted to mention one other. You mentioned earlier we had a youth hunt for turkeys coming up this weekend, but then April 10th is the opening, I believe, isn't it?
Open. Yes, that's the first of the regular turkey hunting periods.
And Ken, you know, before we go to Ken, I wanted to just mention, we had some great photos up on our Facebook page. Tim sent a nice photo of a pair of trumpeter swans.
Yep.
One had the yellow band, but he couldn't get close enough to see the numbers. But there's, you might well see some banded ones. Skip had some pictures of great blue herons eating bullheads at Merton Pond this past weekend, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
So a couple of good shots to go along with the photo.
The license.
Unbelievable length to that.
Well, you know, I thought about that a little bit since you showed that a few minutes ago. And as I look at mine stretched out on the table down in my outdoor room, you know, every one of those little sections, that license represents a pretty cool opportunity. So I look at that and think, well, wow, look at all the stuff coming up this year that's going to be fun to do. So it's a good thing.
Ken in Spring Valley, now we're on to you. Thanks for calling.
Hey, great show, guys. Say, as we are standing and driving on almost 3 feet of ice up here in West Central Wisconsin, I'm curious to get your thoughts and opinions on what kind of winter kill we might experience. I would have to believe that there's a lot of smaller lakes and ponds that these fish are really stressed with this extended snow and ice cover.
I would assume so. It's been a lot of ice and a lot of snow for a long time. So lakes that are prone to winter kill, this would certainly be a good candidate year for it. But I think we're going to have to wait to see that impact until things start to break up, I think. But I think you're right. I think there could be some considerable problems.
Yep. Thank you, Ken. Dennis, I should say, in Princeton. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon. Just wondering, late last summer, we had seen an otter come through our yard, and we are about a mile from the nearest water. How far from water will an otter range?
Well, that's kind of like the old question, how far will a bear run into the woods? Well, yeah. Only halfway, because the other half they're coming out. A lame joke, but, you know, the reality is, depending on what's motivating that animal to find a new home, look for a mate, got to find a place with better fishing, a mile I don't think is at all out of line. And it could be quite a bit further than that, depending on which way they happen to head before they find what they're looking for. So they do range pretty widely over open ground. So probably not all that unusual.
Okay. Thanks, Dad. Yeah.
Drought last year have anything to do with that?
It's possible that the home turf might have gotten so low, or the fish were so depleted, that the otter just decided time to look for more fertile grounds.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Danbury. Hi.
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I've got a question comparing crows and ravens.
Mm-hmm.
I recently seen, two just great programs on the ultra intelligence of crows and how they have numerous verbalizations and how different they talk to their own family group versus other crows. But anyway, my question is, are ravens the same genus, and would they have most of the qualities of the crow, or are they totally different?
Well, they're quite similar in terms of their status in the
appearance,
in the bird world, and I think for a lot of people who just see a large black bird flying by, crow, raven, tomato, tomato kind of thing, but in reality, the raven is a bit more sizable. It's a more massive bird. The bill is huge compared to the bill of a crow. But for me, the big difference has always been that I don't even have to see
sound.
Them. I just like to hear ravens calling when I'm up north. And I think next to loons, it's my favorite sound in the bird world in the North Woods. That kind of prehistoric croaking call of
mine
a raven
too.
Is really cool. So that to me is the big difference. But in terms of their overall behavior or family life or inter-flock communication or whatever, I think they're pretty similar to crows.
Ah. Well, I was just shocked at the difference in the verbalizing with their own extended family. And apparently they have huge extended families that stay together and hunt together and so forth. And their verbalizing is just sweet, gentle, I couldn't believe it was a crow.
Well,
right, it can be. But when a crow finds an owl, then verbalization is a lot more coarse. And
then we got a murder of crows going.
And then there's a murder of crows going.
Thanks, Mary. Oh, man. Sean and Pulaski. Hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
That's my favorite show of the month.
Thank you.
Just before your last news break, I was heading west towards Green Bay on 156, and right in front of me, probably 50, 60 feet up, I saw 12 very crane-like birds heading north, and they were all white. Was I looking at whooping cranes, or can you tell me otherwise? They had long neck, big wingspan, same as a sandhill, and big, long, skinny legs.
And all white.
All white.
Well, that was the second. I'm trying to think of whether it was an email. In some other way, I was contacted by a group of what appeared to be whooping cranes the same size. Yeah. So, yes, it's possible.
Yep.
A big crane-like bird that's snow white there's not much option. So that's pretty cool. And that's a large group. Now, whether that's a group, for example, that represents one of the groups that have been led down to the to the Florida Refuge and came back as a group, I can't tell you, but it sounds like that's what you saw.
Very
that's
cool.
Awesome. This is the second time this year I've seen big sandhill-looking cranes, but all white, so I think I'm doing pretty good. I've never seen them before this year.
Well, I think you're doing really well.
Thanks, Sean.
Lottery ticket.
Yeah. You better get a lottery ticket. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Somebody wondered, well, you've got a couple more things we wanted to bring up here.
Oh, I wanted to make one more last-minute plug for the Great Wisconsin Birdathon coming up in May.
Yes.
You know, go to wibirdathon.org and figure out how you can get involved if you want to help support bird conservation. There are many ways to do it, one of which, of course, is to find those celebrity teams like the Northern Highlands team that
led by Scott Craven.
Yeah, my colleagues and I are involved with. We're going to have a good time doing that, and there's an opportunity to pledge there and help conservation and make our day a little brighter while we're out there looking for lots of birds. So, anyway, thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, we absolutely have to do that. By the way, is turkey vulture should be back. Somebody was wondering if when they come back, they should be there. I've seen
you
some.
You know, either in the last few days or in the next few, there is going to be a lot of stuff back.
Yeah.
Now, the problem, of course, is that, as the caller just mentioned, there's still a couple feet of ice and a lot of snow not too far north of here. So the good news for us is a lot of this stuff may come back and actually sit here in our area for a while things open up north. So it may be the next few weeks may be pretty good birding around here.
And I wanted to, the Natural Resources Foundation field trips, I noticed them in the latest DNR magazine. We actually talked about them on my show here a few weeks back. What great opportunities.
Well, they're fantastic. There are 122 field trips all over the state. You can see them laid out in the DNR magazine, but the foundation also has a 2013 field trip schedule, a little booklet.
Yep.
They're all in there. They're color-coded by level of physical ability necessary.
Yep.
You know, are you going to be in a parking lot, or do you have to swim 12 miles to get out to the island, however rigorous they might be? And it's easy to sign up. You can thumb through them. And, I mean, there's everything you can think of covered in the world of nature.
It's wonderful.
And they're led by, you know, all the folks around the state
experts.
Who are experts in their particular area or just generally darn good naturalists. So it's pretty cool. And all you have to do is pick your trip. Visit wisconservation.org, wisconservation.org. You can become a family member of the foundation for $15, which is a good thing to do anyway.
Yeah.
And then that allows you to sign up for the field trips. And then I guess it says 2 weeks before each of the trips, you'll get an email with details and driving directions. And then it's time to get out and enjoy it.
And time for us to leave. Scott, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
See ya.
May 1st, he'll be back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.